Order, House Labor and Commerce Committee, let the record reflect that there is a quorum. We have Representatives Guttenberg, Crawford, Roakberg, Lynn, and myself, Anderson. The time is 1:16. We're starting a little bit late here. We do have to end at 2:30, so we'll go as quick as we can. Today's date, Tuesday, March 22nd, 2005. Today's schedule, House Bill 120, Healthcare Employee Protection, and Representative Wilson is here, and I'll invite her up in a second. Or you're coming up, and then House Bill...
You don't have a choice, Mr. Chair.
He's a good dancer. And then House Bill 190, Representative Crawford's bill, which we're going to listen to, have testimony, and then hold it for a while, work in progress. And House Bill 180, Workers' Comp, will have the remaining committee time for people to testify, 3 minutes per person, then we'll adjourn. So welcome, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 120, and by the way, I think... that the sectional analysis on the top of it says House Bill 130, but it's House Bill 120. That was a mistake. But anyway, what this bill does basically is bring Alaska's standards up to date with the federal standards. And our regs went into place in the year 2000. The federal regs were written up in 2001. And at that time, the main difference was that it didn't include dentist offices and other medical offices that were less than 25 people. And so we're actually just bringing our regs up to even keel with the federal regs. And the main reason is two reasons. That it's not going to have any big effect on the state at all, because the majority of the businesses, because the effects would be horrific if they weren't already using these things, because of the possibility of AIDS and hepatitis and different other diseases, especially with the bloodborne pathogens. What would happen is that if we weren't already in compliance, it would be risking everybody that works in those offices. So they're already complying to these regulations anyway, and so it's almost a housekeeping issue. But the biggest issue is that failure to abide by the federal minimum standards jeopardizes federal grant funds for the state. So we need to get this up to date for that reason, too.
And Representative Olson, this already went through HESS, which I was on, correct?
Yes.
And this doesn't have a fiscal note, so it doesn't go to finance.
Correct.
And then thirdly, Department of Labor recommended it, right? And
that's
they're here
right.
to testify. Good. Are there any questions for the sponsor, Representative Guttenberg?
Section 2, the 25 full-time equivalent employees. Are there any numbers about people that have had been exposed to bloodborne pathogens? The difference between a major hospital and a dentist's office. You know, who have been exposed to this in off dental offices or whatever. The difference between those numbers, is it greater or
now,
less?
The real reason that dentist office weren't included in the bill at the time is because we had a representative in this body at the time that was a dentist, and he was concerned that it might cost more to put it in effect, and so he had mm-hmm. them exempted, and so that's why the dentists are exempt.
Okay.
Those are facts.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to remember this. Is it because there's fewer than 25 that exempted dentists? I'm not sure.
Well,
Department of Labor is here to answer that.
Okay.
Right. If you want to, you can.
But that was one of the reasons, because if you remember, Representative Fate was a dentist, and he was concerned in order to comply so that dentists wouldn't have to be in there. Also, then most dentists were fewer than 25, so they just did it that way. But there may be other reasons besides that. I don't know.
Mr.
But
Chairman,
that was the main reason.
This is the sharp needle bill on this. This, I think, because we were concerned about health care providers in all small settings,
yeah.
not just
but,
dentists.
Yeah, and that's very possible. But all, believe me, all health care providers are very, very careful with that because of the severity of what can happen, what the consequences were if they didn't. So it's, you know, we don't have, as far as I know, there's not anybody that is stepping forward and saying, I don't like this bill. Because it's something that almost everyone is in compliance with it already, and maybe everyone is. I'm saying almost everyone because I don't know that for sure.
Representative Roper?
Yeah, I don't recall whose amendment this was. It sounds, looks like there's some fingerprints on this thing. I gotta remember.
Okay, thanks. Representative Wilson's like, welcome to Labor and Commerce. And Herr Rothberg.
I've just been here too long, Mr. Chairman. It's a good thing my memory doesn't work as well as it used to.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Gray Mitchell. I'm the Director of the Labor Standards and Safety Division. And we are here to speak in support of this bill. It's basically a housekeeping bill. What we're up against right now is some just timing issues, really, where at the time that this law was created, there were no federal standards for bloodborne pathogens in place. The regulations hadn't been developed. So in the year 2000, this law was created, and, you know, I'm sure that you probably know the reasons why these special exemptions were created better than I do for the small employer groups and the dental groups, because you were part of the group that passed the legislation. And, so basically what happened then is in the following year, the federal government came out with a comprehensive set of regulations on bloodborne pathogen standards, and these two exemptions were not included in those regulations. So right away, the state was at odds with the federal OSHA program, because we had a less strict interpretation on when these protective regulations have to be in place for keeping workers safe, which also, you'll be happy to know, tends to protect people who are going as customers at these facilities as well. You know, when these protective devices are on the needle, you're not going to, you know, have the possibility of getting that stuck in yourself as well, or having those people who might be infected dealing with you in an unsafe way. So, let me respond to the one question that came up about the number of incidents and the size of employers. I've got a list here, and it really doesn't break down employers with less than 25 employees, but just looking at it from a guesstimate perspective, I'd say about 30% of these are less than 25 employees. There's a total of 85 businesses that had incidents in between October 2003 and September 2004, which is the federal fiscal year. And 12 of those were dentist operations, and there was 13 incidents in those. And the other 73 were other healthcare-related businesses, hospitals, and so on. And these regulations, you know, they're the other, I guess, sort of confusing element that I'll try and clarify as best I can, is that the state law that was established when the state was given jurisdiction over occupational safety and health issues required the state to maintain standards that were at least as effective as federal standards. And this is Alaska Statute 1860-0306. So right away, we've got a conflict between statute when the law requires us to maintain standards that are as effective as federal standards, and we've got, a provision in statute that is not as strict as federal standards. So this simply is intended to eliminate the conflict, make it kind of crystal clear for these healthcare businesses what their obligations are to protect their employees and to keep the public safe from bloodborne pathogen exposure. And it's really a common sense type of issue, and our experience from our occupational safety and health industrial hygienists is that all of the dentists are already complying. There's really no reason why they wouldn't be complying with the federal standards. They don't want to risk some kind of liability for exposure and then have to deal with the outfall from that. There could be huge costs associated with someone contracting a bloodborne pathogen in their business, and you know, having medical complications as a result of that. And I think that sums up what my points are on this bill. If anyone has any questions,
thanks for any questions. Okay, Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at the old statute that came out of this committee a mere 4 or 5 years ago. I'm looking at the 1860-890 subsection G. It says that an employer employs 10 or more frontline health care workers shall establish an evaluation committee. By changing this to, how does that evaluation committee work? Because it relates back to the fact that each provider has to have an evaluation committee to do product evaluations. Now, how is this going to work statutorily with people that have very small practices? I mean, what do they do? They're going to be, or if you have 10 frontline health care workers, you have to have an evaluation committee and do these studies, or what's going to happen now? Or when we do away with this exemption?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roepberg, the right now the state law requires that a business that might have exposure to bloodborne pathogens take a look at the protective devices that are on the market. To do that, there's currently in statute a requirement that there are a certain number or percentage of frontline healthcare workers involved in that evaluation. If the business has less than 10 employees, then there has to be at least one person who is involved in direct frontline, I don't know exactly the terminology, but it's basically direct patient care that's involved in those evaluations. If it's more than 10, then whatever the size of the committee, 50% of the people that do the review have to be frontline healthcare workers. And so the intent there is just to make sure that the people who are actually going to be using these devices and exposed to the hazards have a say in what the selection process is.
Look, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm concerned now that we're going to do away the exemption. We had a provision here for the 10 or more, and you're right, it goes down to less than 10. There's a one-person committee. So I guess if you're a signal practitioner and you have a nurse and yourself and you're a doc, for example, you'd be the one person, or you assign it to your nurse. How do you enforce this as far as the department's concerned? Do you come in with some kind of a analysis or worksheet that says, you know, you verify they had an evaluation committee or what?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roepberg, that essentially is the case. If the business has one healthcare employee, you know, if it's the doctor and they're the owner of the establishment, you know, they're not necessarily going to be counted as an employee. So they would basically have to have their one worker on the committee along with themselves to decide, you know, what the best devices were. With respect to dental devices, and this is part of the reason why the dental community really doesn't have a lot of heartburn with this bill, is that there's not a lot of technology available right now for them to use. You'll notice if you take a close look at those statutes that were developed a few years ago, as you stated, there's quite a bit of common sense in them, and they basically allow for provisions where if in the eyes of the doctor, the medical provider, using a device is not going to create any additional safety, or it's going to create some kind of an issue for the patient. Some of these devices are, you know, they're like sleeves that come out over the top of the needle, and they really can't be used in a dental setting because they're too big and clunky to fit in people's mouths and that kind of thing. And so if there are not effective devices on the market, then they don't use them. And so, you know, there is a, like I said, it hasn't been a big issue, and we did run this by the Alaska Dental Society, and they didn't have any problems with it because they said our members are already complying with federal law.
Representative Crawford, Representative Lynn. No other questions? Okay. Thanks, Gray.
Sure.
Next, Patricia Pat Center, Alaska Nurses Association.
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I'm Pat Center, and I'm a family nurse practitioner, and I'm testifying today for the Alaska Nurses Association. I want to testify in favor of House Bill 120. The Nurses Association was involved in getting the original Alaska statute put in place, and the American Nurses Association, of course, lobbied for the Needle Stick Safety and Prevention Act, which passed in 2000. Since the federal act took effect in April of 2001, there has been an estimated over 50% reduction in needle stick injuries to healthcare workers. This is a good lead-in to your discussion of HB 180, which is coming on, because the American Hospital Association estimates that if one person contracts HIV or hepatitis C, it can cost the institution over $1 million in long-term care. Current Alaska statutes exempt employers that says less than 25 workers. I think that was originally put in place because people were concerned about the cost of these devices. Since these devices are now very commonplace, the cost, of course, has come down, and most small employers are in compliance. I know that I run a one-person clinic, and I've had safe needle devices in place since April of 2001. My one-person evaluation committee involved buying one box of needles that I didn't like, and I shifted to another brand and since then, and kept with them since then. I would like urge you to pass this bill so that state law can be in compliance with the federal law.
Thanks, Pat. Are there any questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else wishing to testify? Hearing none, anyone in the audience?
Oh,
hearing none, Representative Roper?
Chairman, I would be curious if the Alaska State Medical Association had taken a position on that or any of the other. I guess it's only the small practitioners that would even testify here, because the big guys are already covered. So.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything in the packet, but we've found there's been a few bills in Hess that they don't, because they don't testify to or give an endorsement or lack thereof, it doesn't mean that it may not be on their radar, is my
assumption. And there's testimony that the Dental Society says okay, but there's nothing in the packet or no verification unless they've testified at the Hess committee or something. Yes.
Yeah.
It, right, I mean, it's kind of lean in terms of the backup in that regard, make me feel a little more comfortable. I'm really glad to hear that the work that the committee did a number of years ago has paid off, and thanks to Ms. Huff for pushing the bill in that regard. And just, I guess I am concerned about whether like teeth cleaning devices used in dental offices, or would they be part of the needle stick or sharps, would qualify for as sharps? I don't know. Can anybody answer that?
Well, Representative Wilson, can you answer that, or is that something?
You have to have cover all those things, those little scrapers. Anybody know the answer to that? So you go to a dentist's office, you got to have a sheath around the little.
Representative Wilson will get that answer before it goes to the floor after you schedule it. Very kind. You look good today, by the way. Okay, can I have a motion to move the bill out? Representative, how about Ledoux? She's excellent. This is great. Ledoux.
I'll move HB 150 with attached zero.
120.
With attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Hearing no objection, with a note that maybe that information could be provided later, so moved. Thank you. Okay, next we have Representative Harry Crawford, South Muldoon, Totem Theater, O'Brady's. Just kidding. Required ID for purchasing alcohol.
And I'm coming.
Okay, take your time.
I fouled up this morning somewhere, someplace. I dropped my glasses.
Uh-oh. So
it could be all over.
I hear you. I know your trusty aide is here, so if he wants to come up and introduce himself, and then we have a few folks to testify, and then we want to work with a few of the associations. Representative Crawford's been kind enough to say that he doesn't mind holding the bill and kind of make it a work in progress over the next week or two here, and looking more in depth. Go ahead.
So, yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee, my name is Jay Hardenbrook. I am staff to Representative Harry Crawford, who is also here today. House Bill 190 basically was a first step that we've been looking into to prevent problem drinkers from purchasing alcohol in Alaska. Basically, as a society and as a state, we have a drinking problem right now. We have the highest rate of alcoholism and alcohol-related crimes in the United States. We have some of the strictest penalties for alcohol-related crimes, and yet we still have astronomical rates of recidivism. It's time for a new approach, and HB 190 starts to move us in that direction. It's not a radical idea. Currently, many people on parole and probation for alcohol-related crimes are not allowed to purchase alcohol, usually via court order. This bill would simply place a mark on state-issued IDs as a way for those who sell alcoholic beverages to know whether a person is disallowed from purchasing alcohol. The bill also requires that bartenders, waitstaff, and clerks in liquor stores check a resident's state ID before selling that person alcohol. So if you have any questions or if you'd like to move to public testimony.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Roper?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm curious if this this particular method was reviewed a few years back when we were working on major rewrite of alcohol bill. I'm not sure any state had actually adopted. Has any other state adopted anything like that?
No other state has adopted this exact plan right now. Several have done specific license plates for people who've gotten DUIs in the past. And other states have left it open, given that they have regulation at some time that they want to implement. But no one is actually doing it right now.
Okay, Representative Lynn, and then Representative Crawford to answer that
just
further.
Just on that point.
Sure, and then Representative Lynn.
We just heard today that Oregon is presently hearing a bill that's almost identical to this, that we had no idea until just today that they were actually considering it.
Okay, Representative Roper, then Lynn.
I do recall that the state of Washington and Oregon had what they called the zebra plate, which was a license plate that did the same thing. But they put it in law and then they withdrew it because it created such a negative feel, as I recall, or that was the testimony about 4 years ago on this type of issue. So,
Representative Crawford?
On that point, that's one of the reasons why we decided to not direct this only towards drunk driving. It's the biggest reason why we have people in prison or in the jails today, not only for drunk driving, but for domestic violence, for all sorts of alcohol-related offenses. More than 80% of the people in our jails or prisons today in Alaska are there for an alcohol-related offense. So what we were concerned with was not just getting the drunk driver off the road. What we want to do is for those people that are problem drinkers that have been back again and again, to prohibit them from being able to buy, consume, or sell alcohol. That's the law today. That's already in law. The only thing we haven't done is we haven't given law enforcement the tools to be able to segregate those people from the rest of society. And that's what we're trying to do by marking the license of those people that are under court orders not to buy, sell, or consume alcohol, or even be in a place where they do serve alcohol.
Well,
Representative Lynn.
For somebody visiting, a tourist, they would simply have to have, obviously it would not be on their identification, they'd just show their own regular ID.
And basically we ran into some problems with figuring out exactly what that was going to be. But basically the way that the bill is now is that if they have an ID that says that they're from another state, they wouldn't have to present a state
and
ID.
Follow up in a different direction. And so as I understand it, the bill would prohibit somebody going into a place where they do serve. So that would mean then I couldn't go into a place where they serve wine. I couldn't go to the hangar. I couldn't go to the Flyby Nightclub or any of these places.
Well, this bill, through the chair, I'm sorry, through this this bill only deals with the purchase of alcohol. It doesn't have anything about entering premises or anything like
that's
that.
That's another law.
Okay, fine.
That's already in place.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Representative Roper, then Guttenberg.
Then just reading Section 3, on the subsection, new subsection 6, says that this license to be designed to allow the electronic reading and electronic display of the information. Is this going to be a new kind of license? I don't understand what that you're trying to get at there.
Through the chair, Representative Roekberg, the main reason that the drafter put this in is because of the new electronic driver's licenses. He felt that it would be good to have that as part of the magnetic strip on the back, as well as other information.
Oh, new. That's right. I forgot we have new ones.
Yeah.
Okay. Can we go to public testimony?
Oh, boy. Big Brother's taking over.
Good picture. That digital license is phenomenal. They have the organ donor, the heart, all that. Okay.
Just to follow up.
Sure.
So there needs to be an issuance of new licenses or when you got a conviction?
Well, and basically what happens now is that they they revoke the license when a person is convicted of an alcohol-related crime. And they have to get a reissuance of one. One of the things that we're going to be working with the chair on in days following is to come up with some sort of mechanism for the court system to communicate and the parole board to communicate with DMV so that there's not that lag time that there currently is, some sort of electronic means to get the information back and forth.
Okay, Representative Ledoux.
Let me see if I understand this. So that when somebody is convicted of an alcohol-related crime, then they lose their driver's licenses, even if it's not a DWI?
Yes, actually, Representative Ledoux, through the chair, that currently happens, that the license is revoked and then they have to get it reissued. And we're just saying that as part of this bill, since it's already been revoked, that they would have to get a new one anyways. And since it's already been revoked, their new license would then have this information on it.
Can we follow up?
Yes, Representative Ledoux.
But once they get their new license, would they be any longer precluded from buying alcohol? I mean, I don't understand. You say it's revoked if you've bought the, if you've convicted of an alcohol-related crime, but then once you get it back, are you any longer precluded? So.
And I'm going to ask that just to supplement, then Representative Crawford, and you guys can answer. But so and we'll, with your question, if you don't mind, we'll use a hypothetical that you had a DUI. You know, 20 years ago, and now with the no look back law, you could get another one. Let's say last a couple months ago, and I don't know what the penalty is, but let's say you lose your license for 90 days. So now the 90 days is done. Now you reapply. Of course, Duane's online, but I'm sure you'll get your license back at some point. You'll have high insurance, but you can drive again once you served your time. Mm-hmm. You're saying then that ID would say in some way or another by code or color, this guy has had two DUIs, or be careful serving this person?
Through the chair, okay. That's only if they're still on probation or parole for the alcohol-related crime.
Once they're off of probation or parole, then they can go get another license that doesn't have the mark on it. And this, Representative Ledoux was asking, once they lose their license at the court, and they go to the DMV to get a new one, it will have the say it's a red mark on the license. As long as they have that license, they won't be able to buy alcohol. It just gives the Department of Public Safety the tools to actually segregate those folks from the rest of society, because we have no way right now. We have the law in place, but we don't have a way of identifying them. So this would give us that tool. Once they're no longer under probation or parole, they can go back to the DMV, get a new license that won't have the mark, and then they can consume alcohol like they did before.
Yeah. Not Representative Ledoux.
this is just a follow-up. So do I assume that, okay, you've lost your license for some sort of do you lose a license for an alcohol-related crime if it doesn't involve driving?
No, that's just an ID form. It's for driving.
It depends on the judge. You can, I mean, for domestic violence, you can lose your license today, I believe. You get put on probation or parole. You can lose not your license, but lose your ability, right to drink.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Then can I just ask one more follow-up?
Of course.
Is this actually giving the tools to the Department of Public Safety to segregate people, or is this giving the tools to, I mean, where does the Department of Public Safety actually come in here? It's the restaurant people and the bar owners, isn't it?
Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
It's the same presently with anybody that they, they suspect to be under 21. The people that own the, work at the bars or at the package stores or any place where they sell liquor are the first line of defense. But it's the Department of Public Safety that helps to enforce those laws. So, they work in concert today, and it would just continue that partnership that we have today. And it's kind of like today we give our license to the ticket lady at when we go to get on an airlines. We hand them a license when we try to cash a check. We give identification when we walk into the Costco. We do this a dozen times a day. And people are getting killed and maimed, and wives are getting beaten. Children are being beaten. We have to do something different. We lead the nation in alcohol-related crime of all sorts. What we're doing is not working. We have to do something different. And when you look at it, balance it on one hand or the other hand, one, that we're losing people. Things like what happened to my wife continue to happen on a daily basis. Or on the other hand, we might have to show our ID, just like we would if we were going into a Costco. We can save a lot of lives and make a huge change in what's going on. And that's what I'm asking for you to do. I know nobody else is doing this today, but we've got to make a change. And this is the way that I can see that we can actually make a difference. And I can't say how sorry I am that I didn't pay more attention to Representative Green's bill 4 years ago, because it wasn't my problem then. I had to see my wife laying on the emergency room table before I realized how much of a problem it is for everybody. We could be any of us. It could be our kids, it could be our wives, it could be ourselves. We've got to change the way we do this. Thank you.
Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, I guess my question is, then there would be no age, so somebody could be 94 years old in a Title IV premises, and you'd have to card that person every time you served him a drink. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, that would be correct.
No. That's the only way, or because it's under Title IV, this kind of reminds me, the committee has before, or did we finally pass it out, that regulatory business flex reg plan?
Yep.
Where it'd be a cost-benefit analysis to every government regulation? I think we ought to apply this
bill. Yeah.
Yeah, we ought to have the same principle to every statutory bill we do. What's the cost benefits and what are the impacts on the fiscal note to the private sector here? That's probably one of the primary reasons this plan has never been adopted in any other state, is that it's the scarlet letter and intrudes on privacy, and it's an impediment to human interaction. Okay, well, the only way you can enforce it is that if you ask somebody their ID every time you serve them a drink.
And you make good, I think everyone has some good points, hence the dialogue, but I want to be careful that we don't make comments on the bill as much as ask questions to the sponsor, because some folks are stand by, and I know Cindy's here to speak.
Any more questions?
No, that's good.
Chairman, if I could just say one thing.
You can respond. You have asked your question, then we'll get to folks on telecom.
This bill has nothing to do with a person's age. It only deals with people that are under court order. And anybody that's 94 years old, I would hope that they're not under court orders to not buy, consume, or sell alcohol.
But there's no way you'd know that unless you carded them.
That's right. And what I'm saying is that weigh the consequences of not checking people for whether they're under court order. It's to some small inconvenience for somebody to show their license when they go in a liquor store or sit down at a bar.
Before we get to Representative Lynn's question, I have a fairly important question. If there,
I would be important too.
It's relative to.
Before you get to my unimportant question,
go ahead. No, that's okay. Go ahead. It was going to be a joke, and you ruined it, Bob. Go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah, I did my job today then.
Go ahead.
No. My question is, what's your joke? Go ahead.
No, ask your question and we'll get to public testimony.
Well, did you not tell me before I came to the committee at some point today that this would kick in for somebody on repeat DUI, repeat drunk driving? For example, somebody might get convicted with DUI, have a probation parole, then they get their license back, then they do it again and again. At what point should we say you're not going to get any more alcohol anywhere else because you're obviously a serial drunk driver?
The judges have those tools today, and they can at some point say that you're not going to get that privilege back again.
Forever. Mm-hmm. And then that would apply. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Okay.
What's your joke?
Oh, you know. Later. Later. It was a funny one, actually.
It's going to be in the
stay
minute.
Tuned.
It's going to be in a minimum.
Good going, Bob.
Yeah. Yeah, right. You guys need to take my classes on jokes. Okay, Cindy Cashin.
Good afternoon. My name's Cindy Cashin. I'm with the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence. Thank you for allowing me to speak today, Chairman Anderson. We want to thank Representative Crawford for this bill. It brings up a problem which has existed for many years. It's pretty much common knowledge that there are people who are NEOCs, not to enter or consume alcohol, and in court language it's NEOC. In the old days, often bars and liquor stores would keep a list of those the NEOCs, and they would be able to check if anyone came in because they knew everyone in that town. The law enforcement were able to just walk by the bar and stick their head in and see who was there, and if it was someone who wasn't supposed to, go in and tap them on the shoulder and do whatever it was that they were allowed to do. Nowadays, of course, as we all know, that's different. We're just too big state. We don't know everyone. And the probation dates with the court system, it's become more complicated and they change. They go back and forth. So there are a lot of people who abuse their probation. And the frustrating thing is that when they are caught, and there's very few of them that are caught, but when they are, if you watch in court, what happens, as I have done, is that the not much is done with them. It's a slap on the wrist. There are some with who have violated their probation time and time and time again. They are repeat offenders. So it's very frustrating, and it's a very big problem because often we have repeat DUI offenders who have violated their probation over and over again. So this is a big problem in Alaska, and we are very grateful that you have brought this forward. There are lots of groups looking for a solution, and we know that by bringing this to light, by introducing this bill, this will bring the topic up for discussion, And together we can work towards a solution that's palatable to hopefully everyone. So we thank Representative Crawford. We support this issue. And I'm open to any questions if you have any.
Thanks, Cindy. Are there any questions? Representative Rothberg?
Mr. Chairman, thanks, Cindy, for coming once again before the legislature. Did you not bring to my attention a problem with the First Judicial District and how judges were not even-handedly applying the law that the legislature passed as far as DUI offenses, and were using an old Court of Appeals case that was allowing people to get off with lesser fines? And is this the same? Isn't this the same kind of thinking about what you just brought up about repeat offenders?
Well,
where the judges are not actually enforcing the will or the intent of the legislature. What's your opinion about that?
Through the chair, Representative Rothberg, I can't answer for the judges. I can't answer for the court system. I can only speak from my own court observation and, of course, NCADD's policy. I think they're similar. I don't believe they're exactly the same. I believe this other bill, which we should not discuss, it is they're exercising their own freedom based on a Court of Appeals decision. In this case, this is something that has been going on for many, many years. The other one is more recent. So the NEOC is a violating probation. It's been done for so long that it's almost the sentencing for violating probation is often passed by so fast it's hard to write it down. They just tack on more time on top of their probation that they already have, pretty much. That's it. That's all that happens. And then these people have a lot of probation, which really doesn't matter to them because obviously they're in the habit of violating it over and over again. So that's pretty much what happens. Every now and then they might throw a couple of them into jail, but they don't like to do that because that makes Department of Corrections not happy, and they send a note saying but sending up so many violators. This is my understanding. This isn't necessarily fact. It's just my observation.
Thanks, Cindy. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Testifying thank you. For your advocacy. We'll go next on teleconference on the off-net to Dwayne Bannock, Division of Motor Vehicles.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Hi, Dwayne.
I'm Dwayne Bannock with the Division of Motor Vehicles. I appreciate this opportunity to not only listen but take part in the conversation. The Division of Motor Vehicles has spoken with the bill sponsor. We've spoken with the court systems. We certainly are willing to support the proposal. We do, however, have a lot of questions that I understand in the upcoming days we'll have a good grasp of the numbers that we're talking about, how many people this may affect. As you may or may not know, the Division of Motor Vehicles is responsible, of course, for producing driver's licenses within the state of Alaska, identification cards, as well as another project that we've recently retaken on, State of Alaska employee identification cards. So clearly the Division of Motor Vehicles, if the desire is to go down this kind of a road, the Division of Motor Vehicles is poised for producing some sort of a mark on one of these three pieces of identification, which will satisfy the intent of the bill. Our concern, though, first and foremost, is number one, will we have accurate information as to who is affected by this particular change? And then how will we get that information? Will that information be able to be circumvented through, as was earlier suggested, by any sort of a time delay or other ways of creating a loophole to get around it? I think those are some good questions that will bear some good investigation. Then the Division of Motor Vehicles respectfully will be attaching a fiscal note with this bill, and then I think that, quite frankly, together we can make it work.
Good. Thank you, Dwayne. Are there any questions, or can you suffice it that he is working with the sponsor? Oh, the sponsor has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say to Mr. Bannock, that what our intent is to pass the cost along to the perpetrator for any expense that has, I mean, that the department has to go through to issue a new license. And we will continue to work with you to make sure that your concerns are taken care of. We talked to Mr. Wolliver here about electronic notification and other aspects that you brought up. Thank you.
Thanks, Dwayne. Boy, you're sure doing a good job at DMV. I'm really impressed. So I just
thank you,
will add that in.
I appreciate that very much.
Great guy. No, he's a great director.
You want the license back?
No. Representative Linza, do I want my license back? But just one more editorial that I was there, if you remember, with a few other representatives. We were there the first day you issued those digital license.
Yes, you were. That was almost a year ago.
Yeah.
We're very, very proud of that. As you had mentioned earlier on in this discussion, our new digital driver's license. I've shared this with as many people as possible. One of the state, I believe it was the state of Minnesota, is come out with a new version of their digital driver's license, and they begin advertising it as the safest, most secure driver's license in America. And when you read the list of things that they put into their license for their security purposes, if you were to change the name from the great state of Minnesota to the great state of Alaska, it would read exactly the same. So I tell you that you need to be very proud of the fact that you are today responsible for producing a driver's license that is second to none anywhere in America, and I'm very, very proud to be a part of that.
You've put a lot of fraternity ID, fake ID makers out of business, so not everybody loves you, but we appreciate it.
We've done our best, sir. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, Brenda Moore, Christian Health.
Hi, this is Brenda Moore. I am a community liaison with Christian Health Associates, and I became aware of the problem of repeat offenders when I worked for an outreach program and we were working with ASAP clients and trying to help offer services to those for people who had offended and needed to education around alcohol abuse. And it amazed me how often the folks that we were seeing were reoffenders. They had a number of DUIs already, and they had not received any kind of treatment or education. And when they would go back to court, it just seemed like there wasn't any consequences. And then it became very real when one of our peer counselors, who was working facilitating a peer support group for people who had substance abuse issues, his daughter-in-law was struck by a drunk driver and killed. And this was a driver who had a number of DUIs to his credit and was driving with a revoked license. And in my mind, if this law had been in place at that time, wherever he had sold that, had bought the liquor that he had consumed prior to killing my friend's daughter, it might have detoured him. He wouldn't have won, but he wouldn't have had a license to present. Two, if he had, they would have realized that he shouldn't be able to buy liquor, and and we lost a friend. And this is just one incident. I know of some others. So I just ask that you please support this bill.
Okay, seeing no questions. Thank you, Brenda. We have two more folks to testify, and then, as noted, we'll hold the bill. Chris, is it Schutte?
Schutte, that's correct.
Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. My name is Chris Schutte. I'm calling on behalf of the Anchorage Downtown Partnership. We represent downtown businesses, property owners, and residents here in Anchorage.
Chris, are you related to Erin?
Not at all, and it's ironic that she used to work here.
Same last name and worked at the same place.
Yeah, same last name. She was here a year before me. No relation.
Go ahead.
At any rate, one of the biggest issues facing downtown businesses and residents is the issue of public inebriates. There's not a lot that can be done to help these people or to get them off the streets because of the way that laws are currently written. However, after reading the bill, it's the thought of many of our members that this would actually provide a valuable tool to achieving that. One of the biggest problems that downtown residents and business owners see is that people who are chronic inebriates constantly go into the same places and are served until they are incapacitated and then get back out on the streets. It's the hope of our members that a bill like this would help curb that with the stamps on the IDs, so that people who are chronic inebriates, after, you know, being, if they get arrested for trespassing or whatever, and it's discovered that these people do have that illness, you know, they suffer from alcoholism, that they too would be able to get that stamp on there, and so walking around downtown, they wouldn't be able to just wander from bar to bar because of the stamp.
Thanks, Chris. Are you a member of Anchorage Cabaret Hotel Restaurant Retailers Association?
We are not a member, but we do work with them.
Okay. I just wonder what their thoughts were. I think we're waiting for that. Representative Crawford had a question.
Sure.
No.
Representative Roper. Every time I look at anyone, I think of Harry Crawford.
Would it be, just directed a question to the witness, Mr. Chairman, would it be easier to get a big red Scarlet A and put it on their clothes on the outside or on their forehead or something? Would that be easier?
Can I make that amendment?
But Chris, for Representative Roper, wouldn't the A signify something else?
I think it might.
I'm just kidding. Okay. Okay.
What might you have in mind?
Any other questions for Chris? No? Okay. Good. Thank you, Chris. We'll look forward to more information. Is there a letter from Downtown Partnership?
There is one. It's being drafted right now, and it's actually coming from, you know, the diverse people that we represent, so it's a little bit tough to get it out so quickly.
I understand, but that might help with the packet. Absolutely. Thanks, Chris. Okay, next we'll go to Doug Griffin from the Alcohol Beverage Control Board.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Doug Griffin. I'm with the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Yes, I'm sure you are going to hear from people from the alcohol industry, and that's certainly not my role here today. So I'm going to keep my comments very brief. We do license people that sell alcohol in the state of Alaska, so we do have a relationship with those people engaged in the sale of alcohol. But we also, in our position, also recognize the issues that were raised by the bill sponsor with regard to the role alcohol abuse plays in the criminal behavior. One area, though, specifically that I, if this is going to be a work in progress, I would like to see put on the list. As I read the bill, I think it is not compatible with provisions we now have that allow alcohol to be shipped by written order. People that do ship alcohol to damp communities do have to have licenses on file, but they don't obviously have the opportunity to inspect it at, you know, in a face-to-face transaction. I think that can be addressed. Right now, for example, we do provide to those package stores. We keep a list of those package stores that are, I won't say licensed, they're permitted, or they tell us they want to do business by written order, and they go on a list because we have to keep them well informed regarding changes in the local option list, different communities that become dry or maybe go the other direction, maybe lift their dry status. And we also provide liquor stores copies of convicted bootleggers, people that are selling alcohol without a license. It's a nice way to say it, but basically bootleggers. And those people are also prohibited from ordering by written order. So we already have a mechanism to kind of screen people that are not eligible to buy by written order. So I think it's not an insurmountable task to work with the bill sponsor and your committee, Mr. Chairman, to maybe see if we can somehow work this a little bit so that the written order trend, I mean, that's a whole other policy issue, but there are a lot of places that are damp, Bethel and other areas that the people are able to legally purchase limited quantities of alcohol for their own use. So that's going to need to be addressed somehow, somewhere in the course of this legislation. I think there are going to be some issues operationally about having to ask for identification each time an alcoholic beverage is sold and to inspect that identification. To me, that's the legislature's role to weigh that hassle, or whatever you want to call it, versus what is clearly a big problem in the state of Alaska when it comes to alcohol abuse. So I leave that to you, and I'll let the alcohol industry do their part in trying to raise any other concerns they might have about how this thing might operate out in the real world. And so with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thanks, Doug. Any questions? Representative Rochberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Griffin, I'm looking at the bill, and the sections 1 and 2 provide revisions to Title 4, which you're responsible for administering. It appears to me, what would be the ramifications if there was a breach of the 060 and 067 provisions in Section 1 of the bill? Is there the potentiality of loss of license privilege, or what are the sanctions under Title 4 as a rule?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rochberg, through the chair, Mr. Chairman, it would be, I assume it would be similar to violations now on the clerk or the waiter or waitress that would do it. If the person making the sale without properly checking identification or making a sale to someone who has a license marked with the distinguishing feature that they should not be sold alcoholic beverages, they could be guilty of a misdemeanor, and they could be criminally prosecuted as now is the same as making a sale to a minor right now. And then if there would be ramifications if the licensee is involved, if it's their employee and the licensee has made reasonable efforts to have their person trained and all the things, but the clerk or waiter still screws up, we look at that on a case-by-case basis. But usually if the licensee has done everything they can to make sure their staff are properly trained, they may get a notice of violation, which they probably would get, but that would not necessarily lead to any kind of an administrative sanction.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Roper, then Crawford, then we'll hold the bill. We'd like to have a little bit of testimony on House Bill 180 because folks have been waiting though.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Okay, sorry.
Do you have any other questions?
Right. Well, Mr. Griffin, wouldn't the licensee's Title IV license be ultimately in jeopardy if there was a part of that? Isn't that always a matter of a sanction potentiality?
Representative Rochberg, through the chair, absolutely, it could lead to that. I mean, it's sort of a progressive, in most cases, unless it's just I won't say that one act that's bad enough couldn't cost somebody their license, but usually it's what you find is a licensee that really knows there's a problem, has been put on notice that there's a problem, and is not taking actions to correct that problem. So, you're absolutely right, Representative Rochberg. It certainly could lead to ultimately revocation of a license.
And are you aware, Mr. Griffin, of any private causes of action being brought by the public for breaches of Title IV against a licensee?
Private causes of action?
Right. That were brought against a licensee for breach of Title IV provisions? Are you aware of any?
No, I'm not, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. Okay, Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was not our intention to broaden this out and make it any more stringent than what it is now. If you were to sell to somebody that was under 21, it's the same penalties. And, is it a bigger deal to sell it to a convicted murderer that's on parole than it is to sell it to somebody under 21? I don't think so. It's the same penalty either way. So that was our intention, was to keep the law the same and only keep it tailored very narrowly to just given to people that are under court order today.
Okay, good. Thanks, Doug. We're going to then hold, as I noted, the bill, and it'll be work in progress, and we'll work with the sponsor.
Excellent potential.
And we will next go to House Bill 180, and we have about 16 minutes left, and I know folks have been waiting patiently, and they just have to bear with. That's a complicated bill, and we have a lot of other bills on the agenda. I'm trying to fit it on where possible, each committee. Looks like I'm going to go down the list here. Some folks came into Anchorage. If we hurry, we can probably get to everybody if they go keep it within several minutes. We'll go first to the folks here who've been waiting the last hour and a half. Do you want to defer to someone else, or would you? There's Doug Williver. You can come up first, Doug, and then we'll have Barbara. But if she wants to defer to someone on the list.
I don't have a timer.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to keep public testimony. So Mr. Williver from the court system said he will defer and come back at another time, but listen to the meeting. Ms. Huff-Tuckness from the ad hoc committee, I suppose, and Teamsters, do you want to hold? Okay, so she's offered to do that, and we certainly will give them ample time to testify. It looks like, why don't we go to Mike Jensen. 3 minutes, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, my name is Mike Jensen. I and my colleagues, Chancy Croft, Joe Calamariti, Steve Constantino, and Bill Sewell, addressed the letter to you and the members of the committee dated March 16, 2005. We are attorneys that represent exclusively injured workers in workers' compensation cases. Altogether, each of us have represented, most of us have represented, including myself, have represented injured workers here in Alaska for over 20 years. And we've addressed numerous concerns that we have with the governor's bill. I'd like to, though, however, limit my comments to the creation of the commission and the concern that the governor has raised regarding premium increases. First, point out that the statistics used to justify the bill are statistics that establish that overall benefits have only increased 7%. The number of injuries have gone down. Vocational rehabilitation costs have gone down, according to the commissioner's statistics. Time loss claims have gone down. Indemnity benefits have gone down. As a plaintiff's lawyer, legal expenses of plaintiff's lawyers have gone down. The defense legal expenses have gone up. Medical benefits have gone up 8%. And overall, the benefits have only increased 7%. So it's difficult for us to understand how employers employers are facing premium increases of 400%. An analogy might be if natural gas prices are going up 7%, but the electric user has a rate increase of 400%, the natural inclination would be to go to the regulator of the utilities and ask, why are you charging these electric users 400% when the gas prices have only gone up 7%? That is the natural reaction. But when you deal with injured workers or a compensation system, or you're dealing with doctors who treat injured workers, nobody asks that question of the regulators. The solution seems to be go after the workers, go after the doctors. We don't feel that this bill will address the legitimate concerns of Alaska employers. They are seeing their premiums increase dramatically, but it simply is not explained by the relative modest increase in benefit costs. The commission is that the act will create, in fact, will increase the cost of to workers, to doctors, in litigating their claims. It creates a court without calling it a court. It creates judges without calling them judges. For the first time in Alaska's history, judges will be mere political appointees, not subject to the standards of judicial conduct. Preemption would not be allowed. The commission will not be subject to the present standards of judicial review. It will decide the cases de novo, and the judges will never be evaluated for their ability for fairness. the power of the board to determine credibility of medical reports will be taken away by this act. A board's finding concerning the weight to be accorded a witness testimony, including medical testimony and reports, will no longer be conclusive. The board's determination of credibility will be exclusively limited to testimony presented by a witness at hearing. This will increase the cost of litigation to employers and employees alike, since medical reports will no longer have the weight currently accorded by the Act. The board will lose its power to determine credibility of medical reports or other evidence not presented by testimony of a witness. This section also makes clear that the commission will review de novo all prior board decisions. It will permit parties to present new or additional evidence. It permits an easier granting of stays without the surety of bonds. It makes certain that all adverse board decisions will be appealed by the party who lost at the board level. All of this will greatly increase litigation costs. Frankly, it will also increase medical costs because doctors, instead of waiting for 9 months to obtain a board decision, will now have to wait 1 to 2 years for the litigation to be concluded at the commission level. Every party who lost at the board will be compelled to appeal for a chance at two bites of the apple. We simply don't see how the governor's proposal to create this commission will save costs, will save time, and will make the system fairer for injured workers and employers alike. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Mike. Appreciate your testimony today. I'm hesitant to have questions, or no one will be able to speak, but if you could make it brief.
Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Jensen ought to be at least invited back then in the future occasion. He represents four other counselors that represent the plaintiff's bar, and I'd really like to... They're criticizing the bill. I'd like to hear their solution. There's nothing in this letter that I have that comes up with a solution. And then I'm really concerned about the fact that he admits there's a 400% premium increase, but denies some disconnect between what's causing it. So I don't get it.
Mr. Jensen, Representative Roper, did you hear what he said? I didn't hear you say that you – I thought you said you were confused at how employers are facing a rate increase of 400%. I didn't know if you agreed with that or not. But is that something you could look into, your solution, or are you testifying that you're opposed to the bill and you don't think there is a problem to solve?
We have addressed some what we think would be better solutions, certainly much cheaper solutions and much speedier solutions as far as the litigation process. We also have some suggestions regarding the medical issues. As far as the premium increases, we've heard the testimony the governor's concern pertaining to, for example, he cited the Kodiak Hospital, Lamex. Each of those faced 200 to 400% premium increases, but the statistics that from the workers' comp division show that the cost of benefits have only gone up 7%. So there seems to be a disconnect between what employers are being charged in premiums and what those premiums are purchasing. Nobody is addressing that concern. This bill certainly will not save employers 400% in premium increases. And yes, we do have some suggestions, and I'd be happy to submit those to the committee.
Okay, thank you, Mike, very much. Okay, what I would like to do, because of our limited time, before you testify, let me go through the cities. I'll go to Kenai, Fairbanks, and Anchorage for the first person on the list. And if you could keep it to 3 minutes, I let Mr. Jensen extend a little bit farther because he has legal expertise, and like he said, his firm solely works on workers' comp issues, and it's critical that we get that testimony. But we want everybody's testimony. We'll go as far as we can. My guess is we'll get to Bob, Seth, and Marjorie, so that's Kenai, Fairbanks, and Anchorage, and then we will have to close because committee members have other meetings to go to, and we went to the limit. So we will bring you back next week. I'm sorry that you've had to stay and listen, but that's just how it happens at crunch time here in the middle of session. So if we could go to Kenai, Bob Favreto.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Favreto. I'm wearing three hats today. one of which is I am a business owner myself, a business in Kenai, one in Soldotna, one in Juneau, and I'm going to give you statistics on some businesses, local businesses, on their behalf that I have been out asking for with the last couple months regarding workman's comp. I'm the twice past president of the Kenai Chamber of Commerce, and I'm also a board member of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, of which workman's comp is one of our top five priorities this year. I just want to share with you quickly some statistics from these businesses. First of all, one business happens to be a hotel, restaurant, and property management business in the area. In 2000, their workman's comp premiums were about $16,000, and in 2004, they went up to $36,000, and in 2005, they're estimated to increase probably another 20 to 30%. The second business is a local machine shop that employs today, probably employs approximately 36 employees. Their premiums in 2001 were $40,000. Their premiums this year will be well in excess of $100,000. The third business happens to be all the McDonald's franchises on the Kenai Peninsula, which belong to Scott and Dina Cunningham. In 2001, they employed approximately 130 employees, 65% of which are probably part-time. In 2005, they project employees about 145 employees. In 2001, their workman's comp premium was $24,000. In 2005, their premiums are projected to be in excess of $133,000. The fourth happens to be a local fish processing plant that's been here for many, many, many years. In the year 2000, he had 233 employees, and every year, 90 to 95% of his employee base is part-time. In 2000, his premiums were a little over $31,000. In 2005, his employees will be less than 130 employees, and his premium will exceed $148,000. I myself, in 2000, with the one business that I had approximately 47 employees in 2000. My premiums in 2000 were a little over $29,000. I now have approximately 95 employees throughout the state. My premiums last year were $221,000. And involved with these businesses, there were no catastrophic injuries in any of these businesses that would cause premiums to jump to those levels. And because of that, we're forced to reduce benefits, reduce employees. We're requiring participation by employees, which we have not done before, and their families to subsidize the premiums. And small businesses are going out now. I've talked to bankers and lending institutions are actually going out and borrowing money to pay their workman's comp premiums. That's destiny for failure. And I'll close with, I applaud the governor and the administration to get this legislation out as quickly as they did, and I would strongly urge you and House Labor and Commerce to get this bill out and move it on and get something done before session, because otherwise you're going to see several businesses throughout the state of Alaska close. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob, and thank you for your statistics. That's what we need from anybody for or against the bill, so we have a better understanding. Real brief, just so we can get to the other two folks. Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a property owner. I have a number of rental properties, and I was just looking at one of the bills on my desk today from my insurer on one of my rental properties. 2 years ago, the premium was $197 per year. Admittedly, that was pretty cheap. That was pretty reasonable. But I'd had it for 20-some years without ever having a claim. Today, 2 years later, my premium is $856, yet I've still never had a claim. What I hear is costs are going up 7 to 15% a year, but my premiums have climbed about 400%. In that time. Is this different from workers' comp? Should we be also going after the insurance companies for jacking up the insurance rates on homeowners insurance, or should is there another factor at play here, like $7 trillion going away in the stock market?
Bob?
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, garage keeper liability, health insurance, they have all, they're going through the roof, and I empathize with you as a business owner and the other businesses I spoke about. It is rampant throughout the state, and it continues to be a growing problem. But I chose not to bring it up today because of the fact that I know that there'll be a venue, hopefully soon, to address those issues. Because it's no different with you than anybody else. Everybody's experienced the same thing, and you know, we obviously have a lack of carriers up here, but we have to be able to do anything I think we can within the system and the legislature to correct as much as we have the power to do, or you have the power to do. But there's some serious issues out there, and I look forward to being a part of the debate and the process when we get onto the health care issues as well as the insurance issues that you're talking about.
Great. Thanks, Bob. Thank you, Representative Crawford. Okay, next we'll go. We have two more folks. Seth Thomas, we're already past our time. I know committee members are staying out of courtesy to Seth and to Marjorie, so we appreciate that from them. Seth Thomas and Fairbanks, Laborers Local 942.
Yeah, are we going to put a continuance?
Oh, of course. Of course.
All right, so I'm going to opt to come back and pass the mic to somebody else who is here, has been coming here for 4 days straight. Would that be acceptable?
Of course.
All right.
Yeah, my name is John David Reagan. I'm 9975. I'd just like to let you know there's four of us here to testify, and some of us have been coming here. We came in Wednesday, we came in Friday, we came in Monday, and now we came in here again, and it looks like we're still not going to get to testify, and it's not right. But what I want to say here quickly is that with regard to the point you're discussing, I would suggest that premium rate increases in Alaska are not being driven by cost increases here in Alaska. What's driving them is that insurance companies paid out massive claims after 9/11. They suffered massive investment losses in the stock market collapse. And companies insuring in Alaska have also had serious financial problems in other states like California. So, in fact, cutting costs in Alaska may not really affect those premiums. But let me go to what I wanted to say basically as a firefighter and as a laborer, which is that we owe people who risk their lives as firefighters and EMTs the best possible care we can possibly give them when they're injured in the line of duty. And by law, that falls under workers' comp. And there's a major problem with this bill, because as I understand it, the bill would freeze the medical reimbursement rates, which physicians can charge for specific injuries, just as Medicare does, and set those fees at the 1999 level. This is a very, very bad idea. It will produce poor or second-rate medical care for workers' comp patients because the best doctors who have all the patients they need will simply choose not to take workers' comp patients, just as many doctors in this town currently choose not to take Medicare patients. Only the worst doctors who can't get patients any other way will be taking workers' comp patients at the severely reduced rates paid by this program as you're proposing it, and providing them with the poorest second-rate care available. Now, let me give you an example. We recently had a knee injury in our fire department. A firefighter came off one of our trucks like you're supposed to do with 100 feet of hose on his shoulder, deploying it, and ripped out a knee. Now, the fire department doctor recommended the best knee surgeon in town. The operation went perfectly, just like clockwork. The firefighter's knee is well on its way back to being as good as new. And that's the way it should be. We owe firefighters injured in the line of duty the best care available, not the poorest, most second-rate care we can find. But the problem is that under the prices fixed by the new workers' comp bill, really good doctors like this one who took care of our fighter's knee, the best knee doctor in Fairbanks, these people will simply stop taking workers' comp patients. The same is true of people injured on the job who have families, spouses, and children depending on them for their livelihood. Fixing them up and getting them back to work again when they are injured on the job is just part of the cost of the job. It's part of the cost of doing business, and that's what workers' comp is all about. Now, I'm asking you to give workers' comp patients the best medical care available by rejecting this medical reimbursement cap at the 1999 level. I'm asking you to do it not just because it's the right thing to do, but because it's the smart thing to do. Second-rate medical care is going to increase your medical costs and your non-medical costs, not decrease them. You try to nickel and dime that knee operation, and you mess it up the first time around, then you got another knee operation to do, and then you've got a longer hospital stay, and then you've got more medical bills mushrooming, and remember, this is workman's comp, so you're paying for these injured people for as long as they're out of work.
Almost all the studies done, including one done by the IBEW, have concluded that the most cost-effective way to deal with workers' comp is to give the injured worker the best medical care available and get them back to work as quickly as possible. That's why this bill, which caps medical reimbursement at the 1999 level, just doesn't make sense. Another thing which doesn't make sense about the bill is that it, as I understand it, it deducts pension money from your workers' comp payments. Now, workers' comp is compensation for damage done to you by an accident, which is not your fault. You were just trying to make a living, and when you have assets, personal assets, this is, you know, they shouldn't be attacked because you had an accident when it wasn't your fault. This is not charity. It's not bankruptcy. A pension is an asset, just like a house or just like a 401k. And punishing people who have prudently set aside money in a pension plan compared to people who haven't is not the way to go. And punishing people who, after retiring, decide to continue to stay productive in society by getting another job rather than just sitting around is not the way to go. Now, in conclusion, I'd just like to say that we discussed this bill at our Laborers Union Local 942 meeting a week and a half ago. We talked about it at our fire department training a week ago. And my understanding is that you had a very good bipartisan ad hoc committee of people representing both employers and labor who made some excellent suggestions. Now, somehow these suggestions were brushed aside, and we got this bill instead, which really is not a very smart bill because, honestly, it's kind of a knee-jerk punitive approach. It's kind of like kicking the television because it doesn't work. People are counting on you to do a better job than this, especially since it's not just a television you're kicking. It's us. It's every volunteer firefighter, every laborer, everyone who's injured on a job. So I suggest that you kill this bill. It's useless. And go back to the ad hoc committee's recommendations. If you really want to cut costs, why don't you do it the way we do it in the oil industry, where I work? And that is with massive emphasis on safety in the workplace and training, both in union training centers and in the workplace. Current law just doesn't do enough to reward safe employers, employers who have a good workplace safety plan in effect, and you know, constant education in the hazards and stuff. So once again, I would just suggest that you kill the thing because it's somehow they just brushed all these ad hoc committee recommendations aside and brought out this thing, which just doesn't make sense. I'd also suggest that you let the other three people who have patiently waited, some of them for 4 days, to testify, to do so. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Reagan. Okay, we'll go next to Anchorage, and that person is Marjorie Linder.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate this opportunity to speak, and I sympathize with those folks who are waiting and waiting. I'm a rehab counselor in the workers' compensation system, and I, too, am particularly worried about House Bill 180, which seems to be taking out on injured workers the cost, some kind of profit margin that the insurance companies seem to want. The reemployment benefit is being amended, I believe, on erroneous data that is unreliable, unverifiable, disparately reported, meaningless, and uninformative. And it is filled with non-settled rehab-related costs, such as settlement inducements, so that employers can avoid paying a 6% assessment into the second injury fund. The reemployment benefits administrator can only find one-third of the costs reported by the carriers for claimants under the program he administers. And unfortunately, this faulty data is being used to raise rates for employers and reduce benefits for employees. I've brought with me some examples of this misreporting and fuzzy math, and I'm wondering if you all may have my testimony with the exhibits before you. Does the committee have that? Hello?
Hi, Marjorie. I believe we do. We're checking on it. It may not be right in front of us. We've received a lot of faxes.
I know. I really have been prolific.
We may not have it in front of us right now because not everyone brought. I mean, again, it's several inches. It might be that. Why don't you reference that, Representative Crawford?
Right. What I'm suggesting is that you look here at my. I have brought about 9 exhibits. The first one shows that my fees were reported to be $75,761 one year, when in fact I was paid $43,478. That's a pretty big exaggeration. Some carriers have actually reported paying rehab providers over $20,000 for an eligibility evaluation. And that is simply absurd. Typically, these eligibility evals cost $1,500 to $2,000. So these are all mixed into the brew. Exhibits 2 and 3 are show the what the are examples of different reporting practices for the sample carriers. And I've broken them down into percentages of their claims costs, of the claims costs reported for each carrier. And typically, for instance, supposedly, and you can't trust any of these figures because they're so disparately reported, the overall benefit, counting everything, is 7.4%. But if you look at Fremont, which we all know contributed to the fix we're in today, they said that they paid 15.45% in rehab costs. Eagle Pacific says it charges, I mean, you know, it costs, rehab costs 17.5% of the eligibility costs. And the reason they report that as such is that they can avoid paying a 6% assessment on rehab costs into the second injury fund. And so they characterize non-rehab costs as rehab costs so that they can avoid paying a sort of a tax. So that's another problem. And if you look at things, percentage-wise, rehab costs, even if you accept these very strange statistics, are going down. Moreover, you can see that these are very, very disparately reported. For instance, let's look at Wausau. Wausau reported paying 5.1% of their claims dollar to monitor rehab plans that they paid no one to write. They reported paying, let's see, Lieberman's Mutual reported paying 0.45% for plan cost that they paid no one to write. And yet they have these huge amounts in 041K, which is typically sort of a waste paper basket for putting in settlement inducements, things to get people to induce them to settle their claims, they put it in there so that they characterize it as a rehab cost when in fact it isn't. So that's just an example of another example of the way that these are being reported. And the reason I'm telling you this is that if I were an employer, I would be very, very upset and concerned, because neither the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation is making these insurers report their costs under the correct columns. And yet they're using these to raise rates on employers and also now to cut benefits. And everybody is acting like these costs are real when they're not. I just feel like I am observing the king with no clothes, and somebody's saying he's wearing clothes when I see just a naked man walking down the street. They have their charts and their pie charts and all that business telling you that these things cost $15 million when they know and we know they don't. And if you look at Exhibits 4 and 5, you will see that overall rehab costs have gone down from 2002 to 2003, and yet they're acting like they're just out of control and rising, and the reason for this 400% increase that I'm hearing. On Exhibit 6, even the Commissioner O'Clery wrote that he found at least 155 people in 2002 who were paid rehab costs that were not even eligible for the benefit. And so that's just an example. And then Exhibit 7 and 8 show that the Reemployment Benefits Administrator who administers our program can only find one-third of the costs reported by the carrier in the legitimate program that he administers. So it's let's say this. These are not real, and if you could do anything to help, you would make sure that the insurers report their costs accurately and in a standardized fashion, and that the Division of Workers' Comp and the Insurance Commission, who regulates insurance companies, make sure that those costs are reported correctly before you make more problems to solve by not understanding the problem and then tweaking it in a way that actually may make things worse. I do have some suggestions for this act if it must pass. And I have three amendments that I am proposing.
Marjorie, and we're running out of time a little bit. I'm trying to extend as long as I can here, but several of us have to leave.
Well,
and I've given you about 7 minutes, so I know I hate to go down to the minute, but what I'm going to do, can you be brief in your amendments, or is it better that you, do you think you could fax them to us? Yeah, it might be easier than you reading through it, because we're as capable of looking at it, and I want to compliment you for how thorough, by the way, your presentation's been and your hard copies. It's a phenomenal job, but do you think you could do that for us, fax us those amendments?
Yes, I certainly will.
Okay.
I'll be glad to do that. Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony, and I understand Mr. Reagan's concern and others, and welcome to our world as well. I mean, we've had four meetings in the last 6 days, last Wednesday, Friday, and of course yesterday, and today was the first time as a chair for 3 years I've had a meeting on a Tuesday, but we're trying to get as many meetings as we can in, but we have other bills, and I recognize this is important to all of you. I intend to look at what Mr. Reagan specifically talked about in terms of the physician issues and what the ad hoc committee recommended, and look at some amendments, and my intent is next Wednesday to go through some more testimony. We could go through months of testimony if I allowed everybody to speak their will and allowed everybody to speak in terms of duplication from other committees, but I think if we go through brief testimony on next Wednesday and entertain amendments, we might be able to bring this back to what some of the folks are testifying to and move the bill out of committee, then it goes to judiciary. But that's for another date. Stay tuned. Is there any question at this point, real briefly, Representative Guttenberg?
Yeah, just dialogue with you. I know there are people, and Mr. Reagan called me. I know there are people waiting 4 days. It might just be prudent to not have a conflict and set up taking public testimony on this and not have other bills on the docket that day.
And that's a great suggestion, which has already been taken. We plan on doing that next week, and my staff and I will pick a time, and in fact I'm going to ask Josh, is Wednesday, can we dedicate that just to workers' comp? Okay, and I think we talked about that earlier, so that's likely what we'll do next Wednesday in a week here, just do it completely workers' comp, and that may, like Representative Guttenberg noted, go a couple more than 2 hours. But plan on the majority, definitely, of everyone that wanted to testify today will have that chance, and Barbara and Doug, of course, too. And thank you for waiting as long as you have, and we will, unless there are any other questions or comments, we'll adjourn at 12 till Representative Guttenberg.
Yeah, I just have a comment. There seems to be a common theme running through this, and actually there's two of them. One of them is small business that's concerned about their rates and they're going up. I don't get a sense that they understand the bill or its complexity, or they're simply going because it's a governor's bill and they want relief. That, and I can understand that. I'm not sure if they understand that this bill, from my perspective, doesn't get there. And then the other side of it is more detailed and more understanding of the system and its problems with the mechanics of it. And I think that's a considerable difference.
So your point is that if they say the rates are too high, this bill doesn't guarantee lower rates.
That's what I've seen.
Okay. Thank you. Well, we will hold the bill, and it's 2:50, and we will adjourn and see you next week. And thank you, everyone, for your patience.